Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's April 21st, 2007, and I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. I want to begin by encouraging all our listeners to check out the new improved LaRouche Pack website, which is LaRouchePack.com. We've made a commitment to have regular updates on the site with postings several times every day to provide you with the up-to-the-minute coverage of the breaking news stories that you won't find anywhere else, as well as the background material that can make sense of these stories. Again, you won't find this kind of background anywhere else. Today on the LaRouche Show, we're going to be taking up two of the topics which we have been covering in depth on LaRouchePack.com. The first is the Nazi roots of today's so-called environmentalists, the anti-scientific basis on which the environmentalism associated with Al Gore comes from. And then later in the program, we'll discuss the role of violent video games in events such as the horrible mass murder last week at Virginia Tech. While the mainstream media has been filled with coverage of Gore and his crusade to shut down production in the name of fighting global warming, and also has deluged us with extensive reporting on the Virginia Tech massacre, the most crucial factors behind both of these matters have been blacked out. To help us get to the deeper truths which underlie these matters, we're joined today by Dr. Clifford Kirikoff. Dr. Kirikoff is a former leading staff member in the U.S. Senate, and he's currently a professor at a major college in Virginia where he teaches political science. Cliff, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be on, Harley.
And also joining us today will be two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, Leandra Bernstein and Paul Moreno. They've been working out of the Lim War Room in Leesburg, Virginia. And for our literalist listeners, that doesn't mean that they're shooting at each other. And they've also published articles in the Executive Intelligence Review on the Nazi precedent for today's radical environmentalists. And they've been involved in the upgrading of the LaRouche Pack show. So we'll begin with Dr. Kirikoff, and Cliff, let me ask you, for many years, Lyndon LaRouche has been providing evidence which shows that today's so-called environmentalists are operating with an economic and a political agenda, not a scientific one. And this is especially true in the case of the recent celebrity of Al Gore, who's using the issue of climate change to try to impose a post-industrial fascist dictatorship on the world, outlawing economic development, especially in the poorest nations of the world, while creating a new financial bubble out of carbon trading. In a discussion I had with you recently, you raised a fascinating aspect of the anti-scientific basis of this brand of environmentalism in the perversion which was introduced in the study of botany and horticulture, which relates to how the study of the natural sciences was turned into a branch of Nazi race science. How did this occur? What can you tell us about this?
Well, Holly, I was working back in the 1990s on an article for the Journal of Illinois History, and I was working on an article about 19th century and early 20th century Chicago horticulture, and basically went back into the concept of the influence of Alexander von Humboldt and particularly tropical botany in the 19th century, and even earlier in the 18th century, the whole discovery and exploration and the location of beautiful and exotic flora. And in the 19th century, it became popular when technology allowed, that is to say, conservatories, you know, glass houses that are warm, mm-hmm. Steel and glass structures that are warm and could support tropical flora and other kinds of flora throughout the winter. In the 19th century, it was quite popular in public parks, public conservatories. You can think of the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. And in Chicago, we had a number of these very large, beautiful conservatories housing plants from all over the world. And the public was welcome to come through on the weekend or during the week. Young people could learn botanical science by examining the plants and the Latin labels. So I got into it really from the standpoint of horticultural history and the display of exotic flora in urban American environments in the 19th century, much to the delight, of course, of urban dwellers. And then from that, as I was doing some of the research, I happened to notice this negative basically trend beginning around the early 1900s that led to what you just mentioned, and I think what will be discussed a little bit later, the sort of Nazi application of aesthetic values to horticulture and landscape. But
now, look, just to make sure that everyone gets what you're saying, that actually the development of these conservatories was part of a real effort to give people a better understanding of the world and
understanding
of what you might call the natural history.
Oh, absolutely. You can even trace it back to the Renaissance. For example, back in the Renaissance, the old botanical gardens in some of these ancient universities, particularly in Italy, for example, are working at the 15th century and 16th century. So you'd see in the academic world the creation of botanic gardens to scientifically study plants, and then from that, scientific study of botany, from that developed areas of horticulture that we would call ornamental horticulture, which is hybridizing plants and bringing plants in for their aesthetic beauty, et cetera, from all over the world. For example, a geranium. Now, probably everybody in the United States has seen a geranium, and maybe many own one. Geraniums are originally from the continent of Africa, southern Africa. So that would be an exotic plant brought to London first in the 18th century and found its way over to our country probably in the late 18th century. So plants move around the world, and this is the excitement of the scientific aspect of horticulture, the excitement of discovering new plants, the excitement of exploration, the rational taxonomy, the organizing of the plant world under Linnaeus, for example, and these Renaissance origins, these scientific origins. So you have a combination of science and beauty.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's clear that you have natural beauty, and then you have man's discovery of it, and then man's intervention into it, which is a natural process of civilizational development.
Oh, yes, indeed. The full flora, for example, if you buy a bouquet of flowers for a friend or your wife or girlfriend or whatever, or when you walk into a florist shop, many of those plants have been developed by horticulturists over the years, commercial florists, and using science to try to evoke a beautiful color or a beautiful structure. Many of those flowers and plants are from faraway places all over the world.
Now, you trace the change in this to the beginning of the 20th century. What
yes, when I was working at the Chicago conservatories and the Chicago public parks, we had a very rich, just as in New York, for example, the Brooklyn Botanic Garden and others. Chicago and other major cities had a very rich horticultural heritage in the late 19th and early 20th century. And, of course, the Victorians in England had an impact on it, as well as the continental developments in Germany and in France and other places in Europe, that is to say the conservatories and display of these beautiful tropical plants in hothouses for the public, that is, in public gardens. But I did notice about 1900, the early 1900s, there began to be within Illinois an unusual development. Now, there's nothing wrong with native plants and natural plants and natural landscapes. That's fine, but there seemed to be developed a particular rejection of exotic flora or hybridized plant stock for landscape, and this idea of a so-called prairie school developed, and I started to examine the intellectual roots of that and found that there could have been, very well may have been, some influence from certain German writers in the early 1900s, early 1910s and 20s that led to actually the Nazi concepts of landscape design, for example.
Well, in a few minutes we're going to be joined by Leandra and Paul, who have written two fascinating articles that are available in the April 13th Executive Intelligence Review, where they actually take this up. Leandra's article is titled "The Road to Hell is Paved Green," and then Paul's article, which I have right here somewhere, his article is "From Middlebury College to Al Gore, the Green and the Brown Nazis." Now, it seems to me that the one thing that started to change then at the end of the 19th century was the intervention in the sciences of what might be called the Huxley-Darwin School. And this also was not limited to plant and animal study, but was through Darwin's cousin, Sir Francis Galton, was applied to human development, what was called social Darwinism. Now, when you talk about the prairie school and this kind of development in horticulture, was how serious was this? Was there really a campaign at some point to limit the?
Well, there was a few. There was a tendency around the turn of the century, early 1900s. There was a famous old landscape architect, although he had not been formally trained in the subject or educated in it. Jens Jensen is one. He's idolized in the Middle West for being an advocate of the prairie school, that is to say, using only native plants and in only natural surroundings. And, well, there's nothing wrong with that particular style, but to exclude everything else and look down on everything else and to try to push it a bit into the philosophy side of things is not so far different from Nazi race eugenics, you know, is a bit of a stretch. And so I think one of the reasons I was most interested in the research I was doing was to try to bring back to life the 19th century and early 20th century joy in horticulture and particularly exotic flora that had been found from all over the world and brought into conservatories or even introduced into our own gardens here at home.
You know, Cliff, the previous occasion you've been on the LaRouche Show, you and I had a conversation about the financiers from the West who built up the Hitler movement and the attempt to create a Nazi movement in the United States. And one of the things we looked at was the banking interests involved. And do you have any indication that the sponsors of this prairie movement may have had similar kinds of intentions, that they included financial interest?
I hadn't found that yet. I hadn't found that. I'm not sure what the client list of some of the designers might look like. It may lead to some of that type of thinking among some of the wealthier clients, but I haven't discovered that angle quite yet.
Well, and just a moment ago, you mentioned the question of eugenics, which is the so-called race science, the study of how genetics affect human life. Clearly, when you talk about Linnaeus and the characterizations or the classifications, rather, in horticulture, you are looking primarily at genetic characteristics in plant life, are you not?
Yes, taxonomy, yes.
Yeah. But the effort was made initially in Great Britain. Before there was Hitler, there was the British Eugenics Society, which tried to apply those kinds of classifications to the human civilization. The eugenics movement, and many Americans aren't aware of this, but the eugenics movement was sponsored in the United States by very powerful financial interests associated with such prominent figures as the robber baron Rockefeller family and the other big robber baron, the Harriman family. And this, in fact, gets a little bit at the question of the relationship between the shift in these kinds of studies to in plant life to human life. Have you had a chance to look much into the application of eugenics to organization of human society?
No, I haven't seen that too much. Although when I was looking at the concept of landscape design and started to notice some of these trends in the early 20s, 1920s, early 1910s and 20s, in terms of landscape design, the idea of only using quote-unquote native plants reminded me a little bit of the German concept of only native Germans, you know, and everybody else had to be exterminated or whatever. So that, in a sense, that's how I kind of came into an understanding of what the philosophical implications would be of Nazi landscape architecture. Now, it may seem a little odd to people, but and it did to me, too, when I first saw it. I thought, gee, this is a bit strange. But as I looked into it, I think the main thing that struck me was how anti-scientific it was. The idea of exalting only native plants in a pseudo-native environment and discriminating against any exotic, what we call exotic flora, being introduced into gardens or into the landscape seemed to me to be completely bizarre, particularly in light of the 19th century and the entire 400 or 500-year tradition of botany and horticulture. And, of course, ornamental horticulture takes us back to Egyptian civilization, Roman civilization. It takes us way back. So this idea of excluding the exotic or the foreign in landscape design and privileging strictly the so-called native, as the German Nazi landscape architecture started to do in the 1930s, struck me as completely bizarre after my studies of, 19th century, late Victorian landscape work, and also the whole concept of public gardens and public conservatories and places in continental Europe or England, Kew Gardens, or in the United States, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, where you could go and see beautiful exotic flora, flowers from all over the world originally displayed. And the Nazi concept was quite different. I guess we'll learn more about that from the Lim youth.
Yeah, I'd like to bring them on now. And Cliff, stay with us, because we want to call on your expertise to look at this question of what happened at Virginia Tech a few minutes later in the show. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live every Saturday on the web. It's on laRouchePub.com, and it's archived there for you. We've been listening to Professor Clifford Kirikoff, very interesting insights into the shift in horticulture. And now let me bring in Paul and Leandra. Paul, I was just reading in your article some quotes that both from someone that both you and Leandra mentioned. There's Alvin Seifert, who is the state attorney for landscape design. And Cliff, you'll find this quote interesting. He said, "Only our knowledge of the laws of nature, of blood and soil, of ancestral manner, enables and obliges us to the design to the design of the concept of blood and soil connected gardens." So that quote is exactly what you were talking about.
Yes, indeed. It's completely anti-science and irrational.
So, Paul, what can you tell us from your look at this book, The Green and the Brown, A History of Conservation in Nazi Germany? From what Cliff said, this is bizarre, but it's a real precedent for this Gore operation, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. What I began to learn from the book is that there was a cultural shift underway in Germany way before the Nazi period, where they began to exert direct political power. And it was a cultural social movement to romanticize native scenes, anti-technology, very nationalistic, and very romantic view of where Germanness comes from in the culture. Like, the idea of being German comes from the blood and soil of where you're born. So this was brewing up in the culture and being promoted from various factions within Germany and also without. You mentioned Darwin and Huxley earlier. They had a major role to play here as well. And as the economic and political conditions were shifting in the 20s and the 30s, this social formation was used to ensure Hitler's rise to power. And when he was then secured in power, everything, the green environmentalist view colored a lot of what he did. For example, going east, as new air territory was taken in by the Nazi machine, they had to cleanse the soil and purify it for Germanness or the development of German civilization. So they really perverted the idea of building and developing the biosphere. Also, is very much anti-technology, which is kind of funny when you think about it. There are a number of activists who were running around kind of like the Bill McKibben of today, trying to organize the German state to end, in this case, the book gives an example of quarrying in the Hohenstaufen Mountains. The basic gist was this quarrying is destroying the beautifulness of the scene. Now, the quarrying was not stopped until 1939. What happened first is 35 occurred, and there was legislation passed to make sure that every piece of legislation that would go through the Reich government would have to be environmentally friendly. And that went through Goering's Department of the Forestry.
So Goering was the Minister of the Forestry, wasn't he?
That was one of his many hats, yes.
Hermann Goering, who is one of the right-hand men of Hitler.
Exactly. Now, but even with that stipulation, it wasn't enough to stop the quarrying in the mountain, and it was only an appeal to the Nordic and Volkish backwardness of Himmler that stopped the quarrying. Basically, Ludwig Fink, this Kibben type, convinced Himmler that there was an ancient German fortress that was going to be destabilized by further excavation. So that was when the quarrying was stopped. And the author does a fairly good job in presenting to you the back and forth. And he tries to distinguish between the green and brown of the elites of the party, but you know, he also makes it clear that really it's the same thing, just different sides of the same coin.
The author, whose name I believe is Ueckeder,
yes,
has a quote near the beginning that you use in your article where he says, "The green and the brown were not two separate camps. The green were brown." And I'd like to throw open to either you or Leandra the discussion of the environmentalists of their day, the von der Vogel, the youth who, after the horrible developments in World War I, decided to reject industrial society and return to nature. Many of them ended up recruited into the Nazi Party, weren't they? Either of you can take that up.
Yes. Yeah, that is the case. Youth were untrained and had no real skill or orientation towards classical culture, or directed both the Nazi Party and Socialist Party organizations. And this enabled Hitler to secure power. When he was elected and then had his way with the whole country, many of the von der Vogel groups and also the Heimats and the Nature Schutzes or the Nature Appreciation Clubs joined in celebration with the Nazi Party, and then would direct their campaigns directly through Himmler's operation.
And Leandra, in your article drew on this book, How Green Were the Nazis? And in it, you wrote about the 1935 Reich Nature Protection Laws. What were these?
Well, the Reich Nature Protection Laws, basically with the environmentalist movement in Germany, there was a big call for protection of very large tracts of land. But because of the way that Germany was set out under the Weimar Constitution, there were federalist provisions, so you couldn't legislate for different regions. You couldn't have these overarching land protection laws. So these groups that Paul referred to, the Heimatschutz groups, nature protection organizations, what they had been pressuring the Weimar parliament for is these kinds of overarching land protection laws, which under Hitler they got. So in 1935, one of the more progressive regions of Prussia, environmentally, they were just elevated to a national level. And their standards for Prussia were more or less made the standards for the whole of Germany. So Hitler, through this organization and with a lot of help from Goering, set aside massive tracts of land and said, "Oh, we're going to protect the little birdies. We're going to protect the small game animals. We're going to protect the beauty of nature."
Let me interrupt you, because this is actually a really important point for people who may be listening and thinking, well, you know, isn't this, as Clifford said, this is bizarre when you first see it. And yet, you know, when most people think of the Nazis, the last thing they think about is someone sitting there looking at a little bird or someone felling over some plants. And here's an interesting point that you brought up, Paul, in your article, that the same Seifert, who was the state attorney for landscape design, who insisted on blood and soil connected gardens, he opposed the development of dams.
Yes.
He also demanded that Germany switch its food production over to organic farming. And of course, as people probably know, Hitler was somewhat of a radical vegan himself. So when you started this research, did this give you new insights into the perversion that took over in Germany in the 30s?
It was particularly shocking. Particularly shocking to see that these nature preservation nature preservation groups had these strange views. And while Hitler was rising to power, they were complaining about how campaign posters were cluttering up their mountain hiking trails. So the paradoxes are just so great. It's kind of like today. You think about the political scene in the United States. We've lost the auto sector. We have a very weak debate amongst the leadership of the Democratic Party. And here it is. We're talking about burning cow feces and grass and so on to run whatever cars we still have left. So the ironies are extraordinary. It's also extraordinary to see that so much of the top leadership was so green.
Yes, it also is extraordinary when you listen to Gore, and he tries to come across as a rational guy who's concerned with people, and then you look at the effect of his policies. Leandro, we've been reporting that Gore has a particular hatred for Africa. And you mentioned, and you've written an article for the next EIR on the decline and fall of Al Gore. Is this getting across to people who otherwise might be innocently recruited into the environmentalist movement?
Well, it really only gets across to them when the paradox is posed. Otherwise, they're just kind of swept up in the romanticism of the culture. And, I mean, just back to the romanticism and the anti-industrialism, anti-modernity of the Nazi period, what you saw was an inability to distinguish man from animal, the way that Lynn says. So this notion of blood and soil, that you go out and you look at a nature scene, and you say, ah, this is beautiful, this is where I locate my identity. Mm-hmm. I am of this scene of nature. And you look at a dam down the way and you say, ah, that's terrible, that's an abomination to nature. So essentially what you've done, you've said that mankind is an unnatural occurrence in nature. And once you've said that, and you hold on to it, then you see the effects of the kind of brainwashing where some of these youth who we were fortunate enough for them that we talked to them, who are advocating 80% cuts in carbon dioxide by 2050. So what our LaRouche youth movement, what the organizers are saying to these kids is, do you understand what the effects of that policy is going to be? Do you know what happens when we remove industry with a population of 6.5 billion people?
Or if we turn food production and take the food production away from people eating it and burn it so that people can drive cars while countries that produce food will starve to death. We'll be back in just a moment. We have to take a short break. And we'll continue our discussion with Leandro Bernstein, Paul Marino, and Dr. Clifford Kirikoff. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you missed the show or you wish to hear a show again or introduce your friends to it, The LaRouche Show is archived on the LaRouchePub.com website. That's LaRouchePub.com. Also, I would like to encourage people, as I said at the beginning of the show, check out the new improved LaRouchePack.com website, where we bring breaking news developments in their full historical picture, 2, 3, maybe even 4 times a day. And this is now being done under a new editorial direction, which is coming from the LaRouche Youth Movement. Some of the boomers were a little slow to pick up the more sophisticated aspects of the computer culture, and while we're not committed to the computer culture, we are committed to getting you the fastest information or information as fast as possible so you can use it, download it, and get it out to people. Now, if you want to call in and order some literature, give us a call at 800-929-7566. Lyndon LaRouche will be doing another webcast May 1st, and we'll talk about that later. So we're going to come back now with the discussion we're having about the Nazi roots of today's environmentalism, and in 10 or so minutes, we're going to take up the question of the Virginia Tech shooting with Dr. Kirikoff, who has some special insights on this. Just to go back to this discussion of the parallels and the implications, Leandra, you were talking about the effect that the LaRouche Youth Movement interventions have been having. There was a hearing in the Congress this last week that the LIM intervened on that included IPCC figures. I'd like to ask you about that in a second, but I think it's noteworthy to point out that one of the senior vice chairmen of the IPCC from Russia, a member of the Russian Academy of the Sciences, Dr. Yuri Israel, came out this week highly critical of what Gore is doing. He said that there's panic mongering, it's not justified, there's no evidence that man is responsible for what is being called climate change. Now, in the congressional hearing, they did not allow any critics of Gore to speak, but from what I understand, the promoters of the panic didn't get too far, largely because of what the LIM did. Do either of you want to tell us what happened there?
Yeah, it was really great, because while you didn't have any critics on the panel, you did have a critic in the Congress. And what the LIM did in preparation for this IPCC hearing was go to target all of the offices at the Science and Tech of the congressman on the Science and Technology Committee, and we got them literature. In some cases, we had meetings with them so we could really discuss the Gore hoax. So when the hearing happened, one of these congressmen, or a Republican from California, stood up and asked one of the IPCC panelists, in 7 years, according to your data, can you tell me if the planet is getting warmer or colder? And the guy couldn't answer. So two of our LIM organizers were about 2 feet behind the IPCC panelists, and the whole time, when the panelists couldn't answer the question, they broke out laughing. And so this encouraged the congressman who was grilling the panelist, and it was a very good intervention on both sides.
So this has not just happened then with the lower level spokesman for Gore's argument, who we've been demolishing in debate all over the country, but it's happening with key spokesmen for the IPCC.
Yeah. They actually have a set of criterion that someone on the EIR intelligence staff sent out, and it basically lists off how they should respond to critics and different types of criticism.
And their main response is, we have the consensus, we don't have to answer your criticisms.
And then they stick their tongue out.
Yeah, Harley, all the scientists there, as they were sitting down, one of the youth put a leaflet in front of each one of six, and the title of the leaflet, which had all of our material, the Channel 4 documentation, the citation of the 17,000 scientist petition, was titled something to the effect of, is there really consensus on global warming, global climate change? So they were getting the upfront, you know, challenge by us. Mm-hmm. All the staffers who were in the attendance got the leaflet and got to talk to us. And to boot, also all the Democrats we could talk to got it on their way in. Another Democrat from California looked as if she had bit into a sour lemon as she read it and sat down, knowing that we were there to challenge her not to go with the sophistry that the party line has been pushing.
So well, of course, there is a big debate now in California in the Democratic Party that was initiated by the LaRouche Youth Movement,
mm-hmm.
which will come up this next weekend at the Democratic Convention in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just wrap up this section of our discussion today by asking you to comment on a concluding quote from Uketer, the author of The Green and the Brown, A History of Conservation in Nazi Germany. And I assume from reading this that he considers himself somewhat of an environmentalist. He writes, "Chances are that a number of environmentalists, and in any case too many of them, would have behaved just as thoughtlessly as did so many German conservationists, who he said became Nazis. He said that their guiding thought would have been that the protection of nature requires the use of every lever that one could seize, and that one should take quick advantage of one's opportunities. Learning from the Nazi experience may be more difficult and more painful than many conservationists have thought." And he finished by saying, "Seeing a cause dear to one's heart, that is, climate change or environmentalism, aligned with a regime, with such a regime, is painful, and many readers will have read this book with the sentiment of never again. But understandable as this may be, it is also clear that it calls for specification. What precisely has to be done to prevent a repetition of the story? What are the lessons that the current environmental movement, or other social movements for that matter, should learn from the Nazi experience?" How do you answer his questions, Paul?
The answer is simple and hard at the same time. It is to follow your nose and fight for the truth of what's going on around you to understand it. Uketer and a couple of others who are a little older than myself, they discovered that one of their professors was Alwin Seifert. I don't know if it was him directly or a bunch of his colleagues. And Alwin Seifert survived Nuremberg and was given a teaching position in Hanover after the war and began to spread these things. And it was only a bunch of students began to ask about some of these strange things that would be mentioned in their classroom about the pureness of native soil. And a number of these brave souls decided to go a little bit beyond the syllabus and figure out what the story was. And lo and behold, they discovered Alwin Seifert's true Nazi roots. And sadly, the book he published is only published in the United States, and not in Germany, because the political implications are quite loud.
Although it is the case that there's now a split occurring in the Green Party on precisely this basis.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the lessons are many, but especially to young people who are in the colleges today, you obviously run into various things that are questionable, whether it's in your economics class or your history class or maybe even your horticulture class. Well, it's up to you, the student, the individual, to follow through on where these questions lead you. And if you find injustice, well, you have to rise to the occasion to rectify it. Otherwise, what you will see happening around you is the whole society going into a dark age, which I guess leads us into this tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah.
Let's bring Dr. Kurikoff back in. This is interesting discussion, isn't it, Cliff?
Indeed. I would just comment on the earlier themes that we were working on, the contrast between German horticulture and his love for science and beauty under someone like Alexander von Humboldt,
mm-hmm.
and contrast that to some of the German authorities. You mentioned Mr. Seifert or some of these latter-day types in the Nazi period. It's 180 degrees opposite the
original.
Sure,
it's not racially determined.
Exactly.
But it's just this the love of classical culture and the also Renaissance culture and the whole joy of discovery, exploration, and science that was embodied, for example, by Humboldt, and then people who followed his lead on exploring and horticulture and plant geography and all and the wonders of the earth, etc. And then, what is it? That would be the early 1800s, and then 100 years later, we have this person you mentioned, Seifert, or some of these other people that have been mentioned in Germany. It's just inconceivable that there's such a cultural reversal, and it's incredible to me.
Well, and as you know, Cliff, Lyndon LaRouche has been warning that unless we get back to that real process of discovery and have our schools and our universities take that up, then what we are heading toward is a dark age. And, of course, what we saw happen at Virginia Tech this last week is just one indication of that. I mean, you're a professor at a university in Virginia.
Actually, I teach it too.
All right, well, this obviously hit close at home to you.
Yes, it did indeed, not only for our fellow colleagues that are teachers, but also sympathies to the families. It was a shock. Both schools that I teach at had moments of silence and student bodies. I talked to some other colleagues at the University of Virginia and some other schools, and just a general feeling of shock and sadness permeating things. And another thing I must say, though, on some campuses, a feeling of fear.
Well, I think that was a universal experience among people in the United States who live in a culture which is becoming increasingly nihilistic, and yet even in a culture that's becoming that, becoming inured to war, to violence, something like this stands out. Now, you had mentioned to me you attended a conference within a week or so before this on the question of violence. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, that's one reason this event came as such a shock. On April 7th, I was at a workshop, a law enforcement workshop down in Roanoke, Virginia, and we were going through various aspects of there's been a rise, you may know, a rise in violent crime across the United States. It had gone down in the 1990s, but the Bush administration and the politicians aren't going to tell you, but the police and law enforcement folks will, that there's been a general rise in violent crime, robberies, and also murders in the last several years. So nationwide, there's a rise in violent crime. Our workshop looked at that issue in general. We looked at the problem of gangs, the so-called youth gangs, the particularly the Hispanic gangs that originated in Los Angeles. Now they're permeating the entire country, including here in the Virginia countryside, the so-called Maras from El Salvador or the Mexicans and all. So we have a nationwide phenomenon of gang violence and narcotics abuse. So I think the public has been so fixed, and quite rightly, on the Iraq disaster that we tend to forget here at home this rise in nationwide in violence, and not only gang violence, but also we worked on the theme of school violence, and we looked at school violence from the elementary school level, the middle school level, the high school level, and the college and university level. And so there's been completely unacceptable level of school violence, defined as all those different grades, in the United States as well in recent years.
And then on top of that, then within a week or so, you have the shooting at Virginia Tech.
Well, I think it was most interesting and kind of shocked me the most was that in our workshop, we went through professional law enforcement assessments of various former school shooter events. And you may recall the Columbine event. And there were other events, too, Paducah, Kentucky. There's a whole list of these school shooter events. Now, our instructors briefers were putting it in context that our children are threatened in school two ways, by our own domestic school shooters, like Mr. Cho was at Tech, but also by international terrorism. Schools are a target of terrorism, like Beslan in Russia, for example. So law enforcement researchers around the world have pooled their resources, and with the view of researching school violence, either through aberrant pathological psychological cases like we had with Mr. Cho, or organized terrorist violence that wishes to use children as hostages or murder teachers and children. So the issue of homeland security in our country, naturally, has to be expanded a bit, I think, and a bit more concentration on security of school systems.
Now, you mentioned the case of Paducah and Columbine. There was another similar case in Erfurt, Germany, where I think 16 students were killed by a shooter. And there was something in common in those three cases with the case at Virginia Tech, which unfortunately is generally being not just ignored but blacked out of the press, and that is the role of video games, the addiction to violent or obsession with violent video games. We have on our website the story of the actual text of a Washington Post article, which mentioned that several of Cho's friends said that he had been obsessed with the game, I think it's Counter-Strike, which is a point-and-shoot video game in which a Glock 9 automatic is one of the weapons of choice. That was taken off the website, never appeared again, and when an attorney called them to ask them why, they said it wasn't important to the story. Was at your workshop, was there discussion of the role of video games?
Oh, absolutely. As a political scientist, I'm studying not only foreign affairs, but also domestic politics. I'm interested in the criminal justice issues. And obviously, school security, school safety, and all that ties into the criminal justice system. Now, law enforcement, as well as professional forensic psychologists and others, know and have the evidence that video games do create mental impairment and do inspire and also deform children's judgment. So the video game issue was very prominent in the briefings as we were working through various cases. You know how you do in the law, different cases. As we were looking through various cases, Paducah, Springfield, Oregon, and others, linking to this video game issue. And also violent movies like the so-called Matrix affected, it is said, the Columbine kids as the way they dressed and styled themselves. It's also said that Cho was affected by a violent South Korean film and imitated some imagery in the film. So
we also saw him in his rambling videotape pay homage and identify with the shooters at Columbine.
Yes, that was particularly stunning because, as I said, I took this workshop on April 7th, and you know, a week or so later, we have this situation down at Tech. And Cho, if you look carefully, there's also elements, of course, of the, we could say, cultic or satanic or unusual or strange. His use of numbers, the number 88, his use of colors, the color red as he's writing things, his black cross with two black eyes in front of it, surrounded by a red heart. I mean, he's obviously into some sort of a visual code, some cultic code. I'm not sure anybody's decoded it yet, but I'm sure law enforcement's going to be on it very carefully. At any rate, the issue of video games, I think, is central. A fellow by the name of David Grossman, a retired military man in the United States, David Grossman has worked closely with law enforcement. He has a website himself, and I was just refreshing my mind with some of these concepts the other night because David Grossman was pointed out in one of our workshops as one of the key experts on this video game school violence thing. The problem with video games is they do induce skill in point-and-shoot, and actually video games are used by law enforcement and by the military for combat training. So what these things amount to for professional use is combating crime. Now, for the young people, it's basically creating mass murderers.
Now, are you at all surprised by the fact that the Washington Post, which had reporters who had this story, decided to cover it up?
Not at all. I think it's a nationwide trend in the media. Where was the media when we were going into the Iraq War? Nowhere. They were cheerleading the president. So I think the news media has completely failed, or the major media, the corporate media, has completely failed the citizens of this republic. And in this case, I was doing my searches for the newspaper coverage of this tragic event down at Tech. And if you try to punch in Cho and video games, you get very, very few hits. There are very, very few articles that went into the issue of the video games and the video game culture, and also the fact that even some of his fellow South Korean high school mates were quoted as saying that, yeah, when he was in high school in Northern Virginia, he was addicted to these things, particularly Counter-Strike, but others too. And so that was stripped out of the news reports I saw. I saw a law enforcement official in San Bernardino, I believe it was, quoted, and I saw a few college counseling service workers quoted with respect to video games. But you know, there are professionals all over the country that could be giving quotes on this, but they seem to be completely eliminated from national discussion at the moment.
Well, there was a psychiatrist on CNN last night who mentioned it, and they didn't go back to her. Now,
it's just inconceivable to me that in a tragedy like this or in the other tragedies, we're not getting to the bottom of this problem.
Well, we're getting to the bottom of it, so I just want to use this as an opportunity to remind the listeners to go to the LaRouchePack.com website, and what you'll see is not merely this story that was cut out of the Washington Post, but the history of the LaRouche movement documenting this case, going back to speeches and articles by Helga Zepp LaRouche in 1999 and 2000, using the material of Colonel Grossman, and also some studies that have been done in Germany on the effect of violent video games. Also, Lyndon LaRouche has called for an immediate action to ban the violent video games, and what he points to is an obvious fact, which is that Microsoft and other computer companies make a huge amount of money from these kinds of video games.
Harley, I have a point I'd like to add to the...
Sure.
There's a couple of things that Grossman points out which are key in this whole investigation here. In his book, it's called On Killing. One is that coming out of the military himself, he discovered that he saw the same protocols that he used to train Marines on the firing range embedded in the video games himself. Particularly the training of the muscles and just repeat the same process without thinking. He goes further, and that provoked him when he saw that in his kids to get political and try and spread this understanding more broadly. He also then added to this study that the U.S. military, coming out of World War II, saw that in their studies and analyses and debriefings of troops after the battle, that only 15% of the military person in the battlefield could shoot to kill at the moment of truth. And for whatever, some of the policy wogs decided that this was a bad idea, and so went about designing protocols that could be used to overcome this process.
Overcome the fear of shooting at someone.
Exactly. It's as simple, on the one hand, of changing a target from a bullseye to a silhouette, or to renaming the target something else, like Charlie, or the ammunition from the ammunition to the package, and so on. Now, another element that's really frightening about this whole event is that when people look at it and think about it seriously, there are thousands of kids just like this. And what's to say that there won't be another one tomorrow and the day beyond? It's just part of the culture. So it brings up the question of how you solve it. And you really have to go beyond the culture and go back to what we were, I guess, hinting at with this idea of what classical culture really is, with terms of Bach and Beethoven, with the musical works and the theatrical dramas. People need access to that to begin to resolve these types of things that are just commonplace now in the culture. It's no longer the counterculture.
Well, Paul, I think also one of the points Dr. Kirikoff was making earlier is the actual joy of discovery in science as opposed to just merely preparing to pass a test. Cliff, don't you see that as a way of addressing this question of nihilism, that you can find joy in something other than a video game?
Well, yes, indeed, and I certainly agree with your Lim Youth commentator that it's a deep cultural problem, and we need to address it. And an emphasis on classical culture, which is our roots anyways as a nation, as a culture, is the way to go. Inspiring a sense of joy and discovery and exploration and is a central and important pedagogical theme.
I think it's also identifying with all of humanity. And let me just throw this out to Leandra. I mean, part of what you see with the difficulty in selling this environmental movement, the difficulty Gore's having, is his main respondents are basically people who are baby boomers who are relatively well off. And, Leandra, you were saying that it's not selling too well among the youth. I'd like you to just pick that up again.
Well, it's not for a lot of the reasons that we addressed. what you said about the joy of making a discovery, what that is it's not just in making the discovery, but it's in realizing what a human being is. That it's not, that a human being isn't just some monkey that's going to do tricks, and ooh, the trick happens to be in the field of science. But to actually be human, I mean, the youth generation hasn't been indoctrinated in the same way that the baby boomers have, where they've rejected the idea of scientific progress as it's reflected in agriculture and increased levels of technological development as a way to increase man's power over nature. Now, our generation, the youth generation, is in a unique position, and ironically it has to do with the nihilism, that there's not a lot that our generation is terribly committed to as far as beliefs that they were taught in school by baby boomers and tweeners. So we have a unique advantage that we're our openness to receiving ideas on the nature of man and the universe and man's role in the universe, we're open for it. You see it when contacts come in and work on Johannes Kepler in the different youth offices. Like there's a certain, they can access that notion of being human by participating in something that's not just a phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Cliff, let me ask you then, given what's happened, the shock is going to wear off in a certain period of time. Of course, the sorrow for the friends and family members of the people killed will never go away.
Indeed.
But what is the prospect that this question that you brought up, that was discussed at your workshop, that seems to have been forgotten or blacked out, do you think there's a chance to get the discussion going in the right direction following the horrible events of last week?
Well, yes, I'm certainly an optimist on that. Obviously, the entire country, if not the world, actually, because this was reported all over the world, has gone through a very traumatic experience, and I think people are going to support strongly investigations and commissions to really get to the bottom of these issues and work towards solutions. Now, our governor of Virginia, it has been announced, is going to undertake a major effort to set up a commission to study the situation. And I'm hopeful that perhaps the governor and his team will take a hard look at the gun violence via violent video theme or element is worked into the comprehensive report that the governor is going to do. So my wish is that the governor's team really, really look into in a professional way this violent video angle that affected not only the Virginia Tech tragedy, but unfortunately so many others in our country so far. And I must say, unfortunately, we have to look toward the future. There may be a few more.
Well, I would urge any of our listeners in Virginia to contact the governor's office and, in fact, insist that the commission take up that question, because otherwise the chances are that it may not be brought up. Let me just quickly throw out one other thing. We're almost out of time, but the Vermont Senate voted up a resolution to impeach Dick Cheney. There's talk that Dennis Kucinich is going to bring a resolution for impeachment to the floor of the House. Cliff, in your view, is it time to get rid of Cheney?
Well, I think it's critical. I think, frankly, I think Cheney has been the, I don't know how you want to phrase it, the Rasputin or whatever kind of bad influence you can think of, has been the main central bad influence on the White House for the last 7 years, so almost 7 years. So I think getting rid of Cheney, putting some new players in, or getting a new policy direction would be possible. I think without eliminating Mr. Cheney, it's very, very difficult to undertake a fresh start. And really, we're in a national catastrophic situation with respect to the Iraq war in the Middle East, and we need a policy a dramatic policy change.
Well, I think on all of these topics we've taken up today, the issue is leadership, and Lyndon LaRouche has recently discussed the idea of a new generation of leadership. I want to remind our listeners, May 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche will be giving a webcast to discuss these matters. Dr. Clifford Kirikoff, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Harley. I enjoyed it very much.
And Paul and Leandra, thank you. Pick up your EIR. Call us at 800-929-7566 to get your copies, and you can find out what we know that the average person doesn't know about Al Gore. This has been the LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us today.